Father in heaven, thank you for our time together. We commit it to you and ask you to bless it. We ask you to watch over us, keep us in Jesus' name. Amen. What I thought I'd do is open source the session, basically, and have, as my friend George Grant is fond of saying and just said in Dallas at our ACCS conference they just came from, the rabbit trail is the point. Okay, so the rabbit trail is the point. I'd be happy to take any questions from the conference, comments on any of the talks of the conference, or questions or comments from the message this morning, or any random question that might have entered your head during the night. And of course, if everybody just sits there, like, rule of thumbs, I can come up with something to talk about. But, yes. Okay, for your basic standard issues in the home, I would lean heavily in the latter direction. Just be consistent and steady and constant with the same sort of thing. There are, and let me give the rationale for that first, and then maybe a possible few exceptions. The rationale would be this: the Book of Proverbs is a child training manual. The Book of Proverbs is a father teaching his son. And one of the things that is remarkable, one of the features of the Book of Proverbs is how much repetition there is. You go over it and over it and over it. And this appears to me to be a design feature and not an indication that something has gone terribly wrong. Right? I've got a friend up in Moscow who's a piano refinisher. You know, and he restores classic era pianos. And when you're talking to someone like that, they sand it down and then they put on a new coat and then they put on another coat and then they put on another coat. And if I came to him around the 27th coat and said, "Man, it doesn't look like you know what you're doing," he would say, "It doesn't look like you know what you're doing. It takes 27 coats." If you want to do this right, this is how you do it. This is how you do it. This is how you do it. So I believe that God, when your son needs to be told for the 10th time this year, do this and not that, this is not an instance of him being perverse, or it's not an instance of high defiance. It appears to me to be a design feature that God wants us to put on time for another coat. Right? That's how I think we should handle it most of the time. Now, there are some times where I think if the child is deliberately ramping things up, like not only am I not going to do what Mom said, but I'm going to fight her all the way. You know, she's trying to spank me, I'm going to fight her all the way. So it's disobedience, deliberate, and then there's high defiance and rebellion. Do I think there ought to be ramped up swats for that, and should Dad come in and make it more memorable? Yes. But I think that those sorts of occasions should be the rarity. The normal one, the standard operating procedure should be you and your wife discipline like clockwork. That's my... Yes. No, same three rules in our house. Yes, I think it admirably encompasses everything. Right, do what we tell you, and we're not going to tell you. Like I said, we're not going to give you a truckload of things. But what we tell you, we want you to do. If you don't do it, we don't want you to lie about it. and I don't want you sassing your mother. And I can't think of anything that I would object to in my home that wouldn't fall under one of those categories. So we tried to model the same sort of thing. Yes. Oh, yeah.
To make sure that something's not going on that shouldn't be going on.
Yes. So basically, no lying, no disobedience, no lying, no disrespecting your mother. No lying means no willful withholding of pertinent information. Right? So no lying does not just mean don't say that you got back at 11 when you got back at 12. That's an overt lie. That's an overt lie. But you can lie in all sorts of creative ways. Suppose you, one of the NSA students wrote home and said, I'm really happy about school this week. Pastor Wilson came in sober today. Well, is that the truth? Well, yes, the truth. Right? But does it intimate something else? Yeah, it's indirection. Or you can have creatively leave certain things out, right? So if teenage kids are withholding information from their parents that they know good and well their parents would like to know about, then that's lying. That's not honest, right? Now, I don't think that you can address this with a bunch of rules chasing them around. Most parents are not going to be nearly technically savvy as their kids are on social media stuff. And so you have to establish the trust beforehand. But I would say there are certain basic things that you should just go without saying. If your kid has a Facebook account, mom and dad are friends. You know, mom and dad see the feed. And I've actually thought that we need to get a special deacon or special elder whose sole responsibility is to friend everybody on Facebook and see what they're doing. Because there's a lot of spiritual blindness on display for the whole world to see. And I think that a family ought to cultivate sort of an open community standard thing, not you have to see me on every email, but just sort of an expectation in the home, the computer, social media, that sort of thing is an open room. Okay. Yes. First, you're right. The assumption that you have is that you're right. That sort of problem I wouldn't say it's common or it's everywhere, but I would say that it's not rare. And I would say that if you talk to virtually any pastor in the conservative, evangelical, reformed world, he could tell you stories. In other words, it's not a it's not rare. So that's the first thing. And if the instance with the is it Josh Duggar? It's like molestation of sisters or cousins or, you know, kids being naughty behind the barn, you know, sort of things. And it ranges from, on the mild end, kids being naughty behind the barn, to on the severe end, incest, pregnancy, you know, child, you know, full tilt child abuse. So it's a gradation, and it's unfortunately not rare. Let me speak to one unfortunately common assumption that exists among homeschoolers and some Christian schoolers, which is that we can move down the road, get a rural compound, get a farm to ourselves, and put up a gate that will keep the devil out. That we can go somewhere where Adam won't follow us. And that is simply not true. It's everywhere you go, there you are. And everywhere you go, you take the capacity to be tempted with you. If you think that you fixed the problem, if you think you fixed the problem of dealing with lust by making everybody wear a gingham dress, making all the girls wear a gingham dress, if you make everybody wear a gingham dress, that's another problem, which we may get to later. So if you say, okay, we're just going to do the total prairie muffin thing, and therefore lust is now banished, you know, get real, read your Bible, you know, that sort of thing. So then, okay, if I've accepted the invitation to get real, read my Bible. What do we do? How do we cultivate this? One of the things you do, I think, as a family, is your job is not to hide your kids away from sin. It's to equip your kids to deal with sin. You're trying to prepare them. You're not trying to hide them. And to the extent that you're protecting them, and you should protect them when they're 3 years old, you should not be checking them out on various sexual abuses. But a three-year-old should know what's creepy and what's not. A three-year-old should know, no, I don't want to be friends with that man. I don't know him. He's not my dad. You know, and you should be thinking about it from day one. And what you should give the kids terminology to deal with it. So one of our kids has the terminology out of the Fairy Queen, that if you see someone out of the mall, some lady who's like the sale at Macy's, you know, 40% off, and she's not wearing enough, and the kids know to say in code, in family code, that's a duessa, right? From the Fairy Queen, you've got a terminology. Okay, this is what we're talking about. This is what you have to be on guard against. This is how you should prepare yourself. These are the expectations. And a lot of times, parents ought to talk more openly when they're talking about the Duggar thing is on television. Parents ought to talk openly. And I remember one time I was a little kid, must have been like this, and my mom. We were standing in the street corner, I think, waiting for the bus or something, and the street pole, somebody had scratched the F word on there. And so my mom took me over to show it to me. And, you know, Mom, what are you doing? And she, instead of like this, my mom saw a teaching opportunity. Do you see that? Where you're saying, okay, it's, these things out in the world don't have cooties. It's not. It doesn't work that way. What it is the way the world is. As Nate, my son, put, and I think it's in notes from the Tilt-A-Whirl, the world is rated R, and no one's checking IDs. Your kids are born into a world where all kinds of gnarly stuff is going on, and your job is to equip them for it, teach them about it. So if you're in Deuteronomy 6. Teach your kids when you rise up, when you walk along the way, when you lie down. And so what is the law of God? So you're teaching your children the law of God, right? Well, if you're teaching your children the law of God, you're teaching your children not to have sex with their aunt, right? Because that's in the law. That's in the law of God. You're teaching them. You're discussing these things. So the point is morality, not moralism. So open. I would say you want ventilated, open discussion where the family, where if something happens and one of the kids saw something funny, somebody's going to say something. But if you have the default, oh, something bad happened there and we don't ever mention sin in our house because we're a squeaky clean family, you're not going to be a squeaky clean family for long with that. Yes. You said the engagement ring, is that what you... Okay, let me say something. Let me give three cheers in favor in praise of marketing first. Okay, marketing, commercial things, or you know, corporations are trying to sell me this, or you know, there's all this. We really need to think clearly about it. The issue is whether it's good or bad, not whether is it a good book or a bad book. Not is a bookseller trying to sell me one, because booksellers try to sell you good books. Good booksellers try to sell you mediocre books, and good booksellers try to sell you crummy books, right? So the fact that someone's trying to sell you something doesn't tell you anything. So you see makeup ads on television. This makeup is chemical-free. What's it made of, man? What do you mean chemical-free? Our product has no molecules. So... De Beers or marketing campaigns, there will be always merchants who try to jump on some ungodly thing and make a buck off it. But there will be enterprising godly merchants who will see something that's good and jump on it. And the issue is whether it's good and godly, not whether someone channeled it in this particular direction, right? So... There are all sorts of apps for smartphones that Christian companies and Bible search companies do, right? And they're jumping on it, and I, for one, am enormously grateful that they are, right? So that said, I believe that the fact that the engagement ring is something that's given to the bride goes halfway on the biblical dowry thing, right? So if an engagement ring or a wedding ring, if the wedding ring is, let's just use the wedding ring, if the wedding ring is very valuable and a year or two into it she finds out about serial adulteries and they get divorced, and it's, as far as she's concerned, it's a biblically justifiable divorce, and she keeps the ring, that is, in my view, that is as it ought to be. Okay, and the system, the biblical dowry system, was designed to make an unfaithful man who was thinking only about himself think twice before he made himself vulnerable to this sort of thing. So in that passage from Exodus I read, if a man seduces a woman, he pays the bride price and no bride, right? So he takes the hit, not her. So that's the way the biblical system is tipped, in favor of protection of the woman, right? So in the Armenian custom that I described with my sister, if the husband was unfaithful and ran off, then he's the one who loses all the gold. You know, all the gold that was given to the family was bestowed on her. So we should think of the bride price or the dowry. Dowry should make you think of endowment, like at a university. So a dowry is an endowment. And the endowment goes with the bride, which makes even a guy understand how valuable she is. So it's not, I purchased her and her dad got the money or the slave owner got the money, but she comes to me an endowed and free wife. A wife who wasn't endowed in biblical, in that ancient time, a wife who was not endowed was a slave wife, a concubine. So a free woman was endowed and had legal financial protections. And a woman who didn't have those protections was a concubine. Yes? Oh. Right. What I meant by halfway, I was thinking of the engagement ring and ring, and then shifted course. But take the engagement ring. It goes halfway because in our custom, when he puts a ring on her finger, she's engaged. Our engagement is weaker than biblical betrothal, if you know what I mean. So Joseph was betrothed to Mary, and they had not yet consummated their marriage. And in order for Joseph to break up the betrothal, that required a divorce. You see what? Betrothal was strong enough that divorce was required. At the same time, it was a different world because they were only engaged, betrothed, and they were on the road together, traveling. You know, we would say, "Oh." All right. So it was strong enough to require a divorce, but he had not known her. So, in our custom, if an engagement breaks up, and it's the fault of the groom, our custom is the bride returns the engagement ring. But if it's his fault, I think he ought to eat it. That's what I meant by halfway, right? And if we decided, began developing some of our own customs, I think the customs ought to be all things that we do that build a hedge around, protect the woman, protect the wife. Yeah. This is going to sound, I don't care how it sounds. I'm leaving in the morning, right? Going to catch a plane. This is going to sound. We have a tendency to react to prenups as though they're crass and materialistic. I honestly think that they're a move in the right direction because what's happening is because the courts have been corrupted and the courts cannot be relied upon to give just determinations based on common law, because of no-fault divorce, because of things like that, I think prenuptial agreements, it leaves a bad taste in our mouths because we don't want to say, well, if you cheat on me, this is what happens, and if I cheat on you, this is what happens. You don't want to act like you're planning for it, right? The whole feel around it ought to be, we know this isn't going to happen. We have higher expectations concerning you, but we live in a fallen world, and so this is what we're going to do. And I believe that we need to back away as Christians from the concept of no-fault divorce. I think that that's been a wrecking ball in one of the reasons we're dealing with same-sex marriage the way we're doing is because of the floodgates were opened with divorce. Heterosexual marriages were falling apart at the seams long before homosexuals are not wrecking marriage. Heterosexuals have done a pretty good job of that. So they're just the cleanup crew on this. And I think we need to come back to an idea of the husband is responsible to protect his wife and the wife is responsible to be faithful to her husband, etc. And so if there's a way that we could couch it in language that didn't get our hackles up like a prenup the way Donald Trump would get a prenup, then great. Yeah.
So would you see that being negotiated
between parents? Well, I think it would be based on for example, the couple if they're getting married the first time, you know, they're just a young couple, then I think parents would likely be involved in it. If they were an older couple in their 30s getting married like it says in Corinthians, if she marries again, her husband dies, she can marry anyone she wishes. She doesn't have to check with her dad in the Corinthians passage. She, if there's been an intervening marriage, she's her own woman, right? So it's the same in the Old Testament where if the daughter of a priest gets married, she's not allowed to partake of her father's table because it's a holy table. But if her husband dies, let's say she's 19 and she marries and her husband dies the next year, she has the option of going back to her father's house, but she also has the option of staying out on her own, right? So if there's, I think the Bible teaches that if there's an intervening marriage, then you have, the woman is at liberty to operate on her own. What I would frankly like to see instead of prenups, I think Louisiana did this a few years ago, and I don't know if they still have it on the books, but Louisiana developed a concept of covenant marriage. You can have ordinary, regular marriage, but then covenant marriage had a much higher bar to clear. You had to get premarital counseling. Divorces were much harder to obtain if you have a covenant marriage. I would like to see something like that where all the prenup stuff was in this category that applies to everybody in this class. I would like us to pursue that. Okay. All right. This is a complicated. This is complicated. And okay, what about the state's involvement in marriage at all? Licensure, etc. Is that okay? So here's the deal with that. I think that I don't like the idea of licensure, where the state is granting me the right to do something I have the right to do. If I were on a desert island, or, you know, so marriage is an institution of the family fundamentally, but it is the business of the state, and it's the business of the state. I don't think the state makes it happen, so I would much prefer marriages to be registered at the county courthouse than for me to get a license at the county courthouse. So I think I need to notify them that I'm married, and the reason I think this is because marriage creates property issues, marriage creates custody issues, and Solomon settled a custody battle, right? So he's the magistrate, he settles a custody battle. Property lines, if you have an amalgamation of property and a husband and wife are both co-owners of a business, they're married 5 years, and then the marriage goes south, now who has the final adjudicatory authority to sort out the assets? Well, the magistrate does. Now, I think that it would be better if the church helped, and if it were all done by agreement between the parties first, secondarily between extended families, third if the church is involved. But as a last resort, if it's a bitter battle and one of the people is just denying God and is, you know, yelling and screaming at the heavens, then and you're not going to be able to cooperate with anyone, then it's absolutely mandatory that the state is the responsible party to determine which kid goes where and who gets the stereo and who gets the car. So if that's the case, then the state needs to have access to the information of who's married, who's lawfully married, and who's not. So what I would prefer to do, and this is actually what my daughters got married differently than my son. My son got married in California, the away game. My daughters got married in Idaho. My son got married under a church covenant, and California has a system whereby you can get married, the church contracts the marriage, and then you go register it with the state. When we had the option of registering it with the state, that's what we did. So. And I recently did a marriage in Idaho where the couple afterward, it was a church wedding, we signed the covenant. The couple had to then drive over to Montana to register it so that they could be legally considered one. Because in the interim, if he turned out to not be the good guy that I thought he was, and he just left her pregnant and ran down the road, as far as Idaho is concerned and as far as every property issue is concerned, she was just sleeping with a guy. Right? And so, and then the other thing is, license comes from the Latin licet, let it be done. And the state has the authority to say, in certain circumstances, non licet, it may not be done. You cannot marry your sister. You cannot marry your fishing buddy here. If you're Billy and he's Bob, you can't do it. But I think you could solve that with registration. So the state would say, this is the form that you need to use to communicate to us that you have contracted a familial lawful arrangement. And if two homosexuals do that and they bring it in, the state would say, no, we can't file that. We can't register that. We can't do that. If it's a brother and sister, we can't do that. If it's an ordinary heterosexual thing and the families were well within their rights, they just process it as a matter of course. So then the state's not giving permission to these people who have the right to marry without the state's permission. But the state then has the information it needs if something goes wrong. Does that make sense? Yes, sir. Right. Right. Yeah, I think the state of Alabama is, as we say, as the people say in the South, you can say anything about anybody as long as you finish it with bless their heart. The legislature of Alabama is doing their best, bless their heart. But you can't just back out of the wedding license business because you just kicked the can down the road, because you still have the custody issues, you still have all the issues that they're going to have to say at some point, we recognize this and we don't recognize that. And I think they're just trying to dodge a bullet, and I don't think they're going to successfully dodge the bullet, because if the Supreme Court decides against biblical marriage in a few weeks, as it's quite possible that they will do, then the state of Alabama will be in no better position to resist with their if this law passes than they are now. Providing for so the question is, if I was talking about a kid who's a senior, wants to play football for the government school, and he's spiritually capable of handling it, I think that should be allowed and allowable for those reasons. But it shouldn't be done because dad can't afford to pay tuition at the Christian school. If it's sort of an expedient, this is necessary, well, we have to do this, and let's just cook up football as an excuse, then that's not so good. Now, but thanks for the opportunity to follow up on what I said yesterday. I think out of K through 12 Christian educated kids, one kid in 100 would be ready to do that. And I think many Christian kids are not ready to handle the secular the land of knowledge, wherever it is you are, and all the stuff that I don't think they're ready to handle it. And many kids get their faith rocked in ways that they're just not prepared for it. So I don't think you ought to send anybody into battle until they're prepared to do battle. And so when you send them into battle, when you send them into a secular classroom, there is no sin called being in a secular classroom. But there is a sin in having them pull your shirt over your head and roll your socks down, and then you come home with all these doubts and questions, and that's not good. I'll tell a couple of stories, and here's a story on my son Nate. So Nate went K through 12 at Logos School. He was a very good student there. He wanted to go to the U of I because it's a Division I basketball school, and he wanted to play basketball, all right? And I was confident that he could handle whatever they threw at him in the classroom, so that was not an issue. And so his plan was to go to U of I full-time and go to NSA part-time. So he was going to do two colleges at once, part-time NSA, full-time U of I, and he was going to try and walk on the basketball team. And so he, in his first semester as a freshman at the U of I, he had physics class, and he had all these different classes. One of them was an English class. He said the teacher, a woman, was foul. She would embarrass, there was a bunch of football players in the class, that she would embarrass them by how foul she was, and she was just like a God-hating thing. And so she made them watch a movie, Harold and Maude, an old, I think, from the 80s, a movie where a young guy marries an 80-year-old woman, and the theme of the movie is don't let anybody tell you what to do, be your own dog, do whatever you want, don't let anybody tell you what to do. And so they watched, and the teacher thought this was the greatest thing since French toast, and it was, and so they watched the movie, and then the assignment was to write a 3-page paper interacting with the movie. And so Nate wrote a paragraph that said, I used to be pretty conservative, uptight, Christian, but I was liberated by this movie. I realized that I should not let anybody tell me to do something if I don't want to do it, and I don't feel like writing a 3-page paper. And he stapled it to 2 blank sheets of paper, turned in 3. So then the kids had in the class had to peer review it, so they were reading, and other kids were saying, are you going to do this? And yeah, I'm going to do it. And he talked with us about it. It was not him popping off. It was, okay. So we talked about it, and so he turned that in. And he didn't get it back for a week or two. And then after a week or two, he was called out into the hall. Now, it's pretty bad when you get called out into the hall in college. Right. And the teacher said, I'm going to let you do this over if you want, but if you don't do it, I'm going to flunk you. I'm not going to flunk the paper. I'm going to flunk you for the class if you don't do this over. And he said, well, I wasn't just horsing around. I had a point there. Do you see my point? And she said, you can't take these things to the logical conclusion. Right? But the subtext, the message, her message was, I want you to question everyone's authority except for mine. Okay? And similar things were going on in other classrooms. And Nate talked to me. He said, I feel like Logos equipped me to interact, to do apologetics and stuff, but I don't feel like I'm fighting the enemy. I feel like I'm tearing apart a stress doll. I don't think like this is really a conflict. This is not, so he was just beyond exasperated with how dumb it was. Does that make sense? Just how dumb the whole thing was. And so he said, I'm thinking of coming, just walking away and coming over to NSA full time. And I said, okay. And this is, I've said, if you've listen to sermons, you've heard me say this over time, you have to, over the course of time, you have to read the story you're in, right? What story are you in? How's the story going? And this was one of the examples I would use, and that is, I said, Nate, you have to understand that if you walk away from the U of I and come over to NSA, I'm all about it, I think that'd be great, but if you do, you're going to get a call from the coach offering you a slot on the team. You know that, right? He said, yeah, I know that. And it doesn't matter. I think this is the right thing to do. And so he came over to NSA. Sure enough, about a week later, got a call from the coach, invited him to come on the team, play Division I basketball. And, there it is. But he walked away with his eyes open because, not because they were damaging his faith, but because he was getting so totally exasperated, damaging theirs. It was not really it's a big pile of mush out there. Secularism cannot really defend itself. So, you asked for the time, and I'm giving you the history of watchmaking. when you have kids, However, most Christian kids, in my experience, need, if they're going to have a college education, most Christian kids, let's say 80% of them, need a Christian college education. I don't think they're ready to do battle yet. I think that they're, you know, maybe 1% would be ready junior, senior year of high school, and I think maybe 20% would be ready for in college. And then that percentage would vary according to your major. Does that make sense? So if you're an engineering student, as I'm fond of telling people, if you're an engineering student, just pretty much everything you're going to learn at college will be true. If you're an English lit, if you're a history student, pretty much everything you're going to learn is going to be false, right? So you have to have a BS filter that works if you go into the liberal arts. If you're going into engineering or computer programming or whatever, you're going to learn a lot of good stuff. But even there, you have to watch out for the core, you know, core curriculum and so on. So that's my rough and ready analysis. I think most Christian kids, if they're going to go to college, ought to go to a distinctively Christian college, not an ostensibly Christian college, not a college where they've lost their faith, but a college where they are still teaching the Bible as the Word of God. But enough about NSA. Oh, I see. So, in other words, the question is not so much about education, but Christian use of public services. Is that a, okay? I think that's a good question. I think it's one we have to wrestle with. And here's just a few thoughts. Daniel was the chancellor of the University of Babylon. Right? Not the best, healthiest place in the world. They had a witchcraft department, you know, and you have a godly chancellor of the University of Babylon. So I think it's possible that sometimes Christians who have a, and I'm in the middle of this pack, so I'm not just, Christians who have a libertarian streak have confused that which is economically that which the Bible teaches economically as the best way to go, or the honorable, conscientious way to go, and that which has cooties. So I think that I would much rather turnpikes and be privately financed, right? If I had my way, if I were as my standard line goes, if I were president, and what a glorious 3 days that would be, right? There are all sorts of things where I would say, well, let's privatize this. Let's move this to the private sector. But I don't believe that it's true to say that a Christian is morally compromised because he listened to NPR for half an hour, or morally compromised because he took the metro, or morally compromised because he utilized a public service that he would vote against if he were in a position to vote on its establishment, right? So my view of life in modern America is they have locked me in the casino and they are making me place bets, right? I could keel over here right now. I could just black out, keel over, and come to in a nearby hospital owing somebody I never met $75,000, right? And there's no place I can go to opt out of that system, right? I'm in the casino, they're making me place bets, so what I want to do is urge Christians to walk gradually, slowly, systematically, walk their way out. And the way I teach on this is I say, refuse the benefits first. So refuse the benefits first. Don't try to get your piece of the FEMA disaster relief action. Don't, you know, that sort of thing. Don't don't take Social Security for everything you can get from them. There's all sorts of, and one of those factors would be public universities. So if you have an alternative, so if God's called you to XYZ, and you have a private alternative that you can afford, I would urge people to take the private alternative. Go that route whenever possible. Does that make sense? Yes. Okay, last one. Make it a ripe one. I think it was a tactical mistake. I think public education in a Christian society is a tactical mistake, not a moral mistake. Does that make sense? My principal objection to government education is that it's godless, not that it's funded by taxes. Okay? Now, I do have objections to the tax funding of government schools, but if you had a Christian republic, let's say, and in Scotland, John Knox was one of the people responsible for the formation of what later became public education. So John Knox is responsible for that. But remember, that was a Christian republic, and a lot of the governmental functions were funded by what they called the tiens, or the tithes. Right? So in a Christian republic, the tithe is not something you voluntarily put in the plate in the denomination of your voluntaristic choice. The tithe was your tax. You paid your tithe in taxes. So in a Christian republic where it was the tithe based on the Bible's requirement of a tithe, and then you take part of that tithe in order to teach children to read so that they can read the Bible. Okay, I might have some pragmatic arguments based on the nature and trajectory of how bureaucracies go. But I wouldn't have the same moral objections that I would have to our godless form of education. Does that make sense? So I think that... Yes. And to fight that old deceiver, Satan, it was called the Old Deceiver Satan Act. And well, that was the Northwest Territory Act, I think. But so basically, that's the issue. So, I believe that at certain sizes, even in the church, if you have a large denomination paying tithes to central headquarters, inefficiencies creep in, and the bureaucratic mentality creeps in. Even if it's just the church, and even if it's a Christian republic, if God's prospering you with incredible wealth and you're giving a tenth of it to the state, and then you're doing, I have all kinds of low. Let's not do that. But those would be libertarian pragmatic arguments, as opposed to my objection to the godless form of education, which is don't give your children to the devil.